So the talk tonight is about joy. Joy in practice. Joy in our lives. And then I'll say a little bit about integrating back into the world, a little more than we've already said. So let's be really clear. Buddhism is not about the first noble truth. Right? There's four noble truths. And the first noble truth that there's suffering in life, you know, the stereotype is, you know, Buddhism just focuses on that. And it's not at all the truth. It's like we have to start with the diagnosis so that we can know the cure. The cure is the point of Buddhism. And the cure is that there is lasting happiness. And that's the third noble truth. And the fourth noble truth is the path that leads to lasting happiness, which is the Eightfold Path. This practice is about joy. There's a very technical scholarly book written by a really highly regarded scholar monk, Analeo. How do you say his name?
I never know.
Analeo. And he wrote a whole book on the one sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Buddha's mindfulness instructions. And he's a monk. And he said the entire scheme of the gradual training of the Eightfold Path can be envisaged as a progressive refinement of joy. Yay. Ajahn Buddhadasa, a very renowned teacher from Thailand in the 20th century, said one needs to develop perpetual spiritual joy. Does that fit your stereotype of a Theravada monk, total renunciant, lots of collarbone showing? you know, we can actually look at the Theravada monastic tradition, and from our Western lay perspective, it can look pretty severe, actually, from the outside. But on the inside, this is the point, perpetual spiritual joy. It's just a highly renunciant way of going there. But still, the point is joy. But it's a joy that's worthy of our deepest self-respect. A happiness that isn't insecure. A happiness that is secure needs to depend on secure things, not insecure things like sense pleasures, mind states, relationships, all the things that, you know, we love. They're great. And so this is not to ever knock it. We never want to use our spiritual practice to bum us out about what does work in our lives. The only point of this practice is about what works. But the Buddha wasn't messing around. He wasn't delivering spirituality, L-I-T-E. He was on a relentless quest in his own quest to find the happiness that really worked. And he mastered, so the tradition says, all of the meditative techniques that were available at the time. And he had incredible states of joy, of total bliss, of jhanas, of powerful meditative absorptions. But then they would end. You have to come out of the jhana eventually. And it didn't solve the Buddha's problem. But then, 2,500 years ago, the Buddha sat down under a tree and solved not just his problem, but your problem and my problem. He found a way to deep, true, lasting happiness, one that doesn't depend on changing things. If your happiness depends on a changing thing, then your happiness is insecure. It's great while the pleasant lasts, but as soon as the pleasant goes, our happiness topples. So this is setting the bar very high to find a way to be happy that doesn't depend on pleasure. That's the crux of our problem, is that we base our happiness on pleasantness. But we need to know how to be happy, as I said in the beginning of the retreat, with life actually as it is, which is pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So, but this sets the bar very high. So you don't want to use any of these teachings to downgrade whatever's working for you. If it's working, then it's working. So to only use this to augment what's already working, but we do have a choice to find a happiness that doesn't depend on pleasure. Until you know that experience for yourself, it's not really a choice. You don't have a choice until you know there's a choice. But when you have had the experience that, oh, I can sit here and actually be content with knee pain, or an itch on my back, or anxiety, or restlessness, I can actually be okay in the midst of that, then you know you have a choice. There is an alternative. You can actually be truly happy, because to me, this is the most practical way of defining freedom or enlightenment. You don't care. You could care less if the next moment is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. If that's you, you are free. So, it's not trivial, non-trivial, when we sit and push our edge a little bit with unpleasant experiences, and we've all had gobs of them on this retreat. You can't do retreat and not do a lot of unpleasant. Our hope in this beautiful place and with this beautiful practice, that you also had a lot of pleasant. And for sure, we've all had neutral. The question is whether we noticed it or not, because we usually ignore it. So true freedom is this balanced, equanimous relationship with pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And when we have that, that's true happiness. The Buddha said, the deepest happiness is peace. Peace. Not being rocked to and fro by the play of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Being totally at peace as pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral does its dance. Because that never stops. So Bhante Gunaratana, the Sri Lankan monk and teacher who's now very elderly, he's been in robes probably 70 or 80 years. He was ordained very young, lives in Virginia, and he wrote the book Mindfulness in Plain English, with which Mary quoted from, and I want to quote from it as well. He writes, "You can't ever get everything you want. It's impossible. Luckily, there is another option. You can learn to step outside the endless cycle of desire and aversion. You can learn not to want what you want, to recognize desires, but not be controlled by them. You want something, but you don't have to chase after it. You fear something, but you don't have to stand there quaking in your boots. This mental cultivation is very difficult. It takes years. But trying to control everything is impossible. The difficult is preferable to the impossible." He's really talking about pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Trying to control your life so that you can always have a pleasant experience. It's exhausting after a while. It's so hard. The trying itself is unpleasant. So we can't win, in a way. We need to practice contentment And we need to, like Byron Katie says, love what is. What is happening, she also says, should be happening. If it is happening, it should be happening. There is no should other than reality. So when we practice, we see this more and more deeply, that the play of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral is unstoppable and out of our control. And it's not where our happiness lies. Our happiness lies in the mindfulness that keeps us balanced. A wise friend said this to me once, the less I practice, the more in control I think I am. To think you're in control is delusion. It's actually really good news to get that it's out of control. It's why nature's such a good teacher. We might prefer weather to be certain ways, you know, and like it when it's really pleasant like this. But we don't take it very personally. We don't stress out like, God, it's raining today. What's wrong with me? We actually just relate to it like weather. And when it's raining, we put on a raincoat. We can have that totally matter-of-fact relationship with ourselves. We can say, sad, without at all feeling what's wrong with me. Oh, sadness. Oh, just like we relate to weather. So the more we see we're not in charge of our ups and downs, we're not in charge of our amazingly pinballing thoughts. Like, how many different things do you think you have thought about in this 5 days? I mean, all of world history, all of personal history, all of, I don't know, evolutionary biology, because I gave you that guided thing. I mean, we've covered so much ground, but a lot of it is our mind just pinballing in this incredibly fast association game. Try to control that. Good luck. Then we can start to see our thoughts like weather. We want to, you know, we want to be prepared. We want to wear the right clothes for the right thoughts. But, you know, we're not really so in control. But it's actually a huge relief as we start getting this. Wow, look at those thoughts. Isn't that amazing? Look at that little pinball thing. I had an experience once of deep unworthiness on retreat, but I was being really mindful. And I saw the whole thing unfold all by itself. I heard a twang on the thermostat on the wall at Spirit Rock. And it reminded me of someone plucking a bass. So the next thought, the next moment was a bass line in a John Coltrane jazz tune. And then I'm like, ah. The next moment was Coltrane. Bliss. And then the next moment was infant bliss, like a baby. And then I thought of my godson, Luca. Let me relanguage it. Then the thought came of my godson, Luca. And I was babysitting him once when he was one. And I put him, he loved to sit in his car seat, and I put him on the floor. And I was going into the kitchen to get a chocolate chip cookie. And I didn't place him mindfully. And as I stepped away, the thing toppled. And he hit his head and was bawling. And so I had that memory. So click on the wall, baseline, bliss, Luca, car seat toppling, bawling infant. And all I wanted was a chocolate chip cookie. And like I practically gave this poor guy like a head injury. He was fine. But so I went into this incredible feeling of like, God, I'm so greedy. What's wrong with me? And then, but I watched the whole show, and it was all it was the brain. Now I could have just landed. Oh God, that unworthiness! I can watch all those other thoughts and let them go by, but not this one. I really am unworthy. That's one we can all share. My retreat, my practice at this point in retreat was deep enough where I didn't just land and start believing that thought. I actually kept seeing, oh my God, look where that unworthiness came from, out of thin air. I'm in control of that? No way. It's just my mind unfolding due to conditions and memory and association. So I'm not in control of that. And what a relief. I can just watch it. It's much funner to watch it than to take it personally. The more we see it's not in our control, you know, the more we practice, the more we see it's not in our control, the more we relax and stop stressing and just get it. Life will always have problems. Life will always have ups and downs. That we don't get out of it. The 17th Karmapa, I heard him say that. My life is full of problems. He's one of the most realized beings in Tibetan Buddhism. And he said that. I was amazed. My life is full of problems. You know, he's got this, he's head of a whole order of Tibetan Buddhism, and he's, you know, one of the spiritual heirs maybe to the Dalai Lama when the Dalai Lama dies. And he's got a lot on his plate. His life's full of problems. We can be truly happy in a life full of problems. The problems don't go away, but our attitude changes. The more we practice, the more we let go of control, the more we realize that our true home is here, in our heart, in the aware, awakened, loving heart. That's our refuge. That's where we can actually have a lasting, true joy. And mindfulness is the gateway into it. And mindfulness teaches us this. We back into natural peace, natural happiness through the gateway of mindfulness practice. We start letting go more and more. And when we let go, we're just happy. And as we practice, we really get that, oh my God. And it seems so obvious to say, but so hard to really realize. It's only ever this moment. Only ever here and now. That's all we ever have. Therefore, the biggest reality need is not paying our mortgages on time, making sure the kids get into a good school, you know, getting the car fixed, having a career that is both rewarding monetarily and fulfilling emotionally. Those are not our biggest reality needs. The most practical thing you can do is learn how to be with this moment, because it's only ever this moment. If we can surf this moment, then we can do all moments, because we're always going to be right here. So we've been practicing this for a whole week, and we've watched our minds project wildly, incessantly, into past and future. We project into the future. We actually create the past by having selective memory, and then, as Mary showed, even a given memory that was selected out of all the many we could have had, we have one, but even that is selective, and only little nuggets are remembered, and the rest just gets filled in. We literally create the past with memory, and we project and imagine the future. And while we do that, we completely miss the practical task at hand. Our reality need, our ultimate reality need, is always just to know this moment. If we can do that, we can do life. We know how to live. So this is the key moment. If taking care of this moment takes care of all moments. So we have practiced an incredibly practical skill. It's nothing woo-woo about this. It is deeply practical. So this is the flavor of the tradition. It's about happiness, But it's not L-I-T-E. It's a happiness that's worthy of our deepest self-respect. Don't we all want true, lasting, never-ending happiness? Well, that's what this path is about. It's just hard. It isn't easy to do this. And again, it's setting the bar very high to say, don't base your happiness on pleasure. Base it on mindfulness. You know, it's easy to say. Very hard to do. You know, so we just, but every little step of increasing your comfort with the play of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral through mindfulness, every step in that direction makes us happier and freer, more free. So you have your own bar and how high you want your own bar. And that's your business. We are all on our own path. But just know this practice, you know, the cell is that we can go all the way. This practice can take us all the way to full awakening, to being totally at ease, while deeply connected with life exactly as it is, with all the chaos and turmoil and change. So that's one side of the practice. But we need to add some other ingredients. And one of the ingredients we need to add is a conscious, purposeful cultivation of joy. Because we have a negativity bias. The brain, the human brain, has been shown to have a negativity bias. Our teaching friend, Rick Hansen, in his book, Buddha's Brain, writes, part of being human is to have a brain that selectively scans for, registers, stores, recalls, and reacts to unpleasant experiences. The brain is like Velcro for negative experiences and Teflon for positive ones. So he's summarizing some of the neuroscience research. He says the brain detects negative information much faster than positive information. Take facial expressions. You know, about as important an indicator, you know, of our environment as is out there. Our environment is a social environment. So facial expressions and how we react to them, very important. The brain recognizes fearful expressions much more quickly than happy or neutral ones. It's like our brain is basically, the theory is, evolved to be kind of on threat alert. And apparently the brains that were more on threat alert had a better survival value. You know, the dude just chilling out by the campfire, you know, became lion food. I don't know, whereas the anxious, you know, nerdy guy, there could be a tiger, a lion lurking, survive, because I don't know. I mean, I'm just completely making that up. But we all know this from relationships. John Gottman, one of the main researchers on marriage and what works in marriage, has shown that, well, we all know this too. It takes about 5 positive interactions in a relationship to overcome 1 negative one. We take in the negative so quickly and deeply. So we have to consciously, actively go against the grain and look for the positive, enjoy the positive, and remember the positive. We need this, don't we? It's not Pollyanna to focus on the positive. It's a reality need. It counteracts the negativity bias. So there's a practice in Dharma called mudita, where we actually, go on the lookout for happiness. And when we see it, we celebrate it. So this is a practice you could take home. Look around when you're out and notice happiness anywhere. And when you see it, celebrate it quietly to yourself. Yeah, you jump up and down, jump. But the phrase is like metta practice, but it's focused more on joy. And it's cultivating joy, but it's called sympathetic joy, mudita, where the happiness of others can gladden our hearts. The Dalai Lama has a little one-liner about this. Why not make other people's happiness your happiness? It'll increase your chances by 7 billion to 1. Be on the lookout. You know, when you leave retreat, you could, you know, this could be something to take with you. Just start looking for happiness. And when you see it, send the person a silent little wish. A mudita wish is something like this. I'm glad you're happy. That's a simple one. Or you could party a little harder and you could say, may your happiness only increase. And if you want a turbo party, go to the after party. You could say, may you always be this happy. Now it's not a practice that's logical. Doesn't matter. It's a heart connection practice. It's the idea is for you to activate your mudita cells in your heart instead of your jealousy cells. It's the opposite. Instead of someone's happiness, you know, diminishing ours, it's the opposite. It increases ours because actually it's natural in our heart. When we're not in comparing mind, it's just happiness. So, I'm glad you're happy, or may your happiness only increase, or may you always be this happy. And that's like a practice that you can just take out with you in life and do it. See, you know, if that strikes your fancy. So that's one way to cultivate consciously joy. I'm blinded, I can't even see that. A second way, which we're all familiar with, is gratitude. Isn't it nice to say thank you? To notice something that you feel thankful for? So gratitude is a big one. And one of the most famous poems in Japanese literature is a gratitude poem. It's only 3 lines. And it's written by Ryokan. And he was a practitioner in the 1700s to the 1800s. And he was really devoted to practice, and he became the abbot of a monastery, but he didn't like, you know, being larger than in charge. So he gave up the abbot life and then moved back to his hometown and became a beggar. And he lived in a simple hut. He loved children. He loved playing with kids. He often forgot to go beg for food because he was playing with kids. He was known as super gentle and super kind. And once, when he came back to his hut, he saw that a thief had come by and stolen his totally meager belongings. The story, the legend is that Ryokan ran after the thief and said, wait, you forgot this. It was his meditation cushion. I don't know if he caught, I guess he gave it to the thief. This was a guy very let go. He was in a state of, if you go by this poem, maybe perpetual gratitude, I don't know. But here's the poem that came from that experience. The thief left it behind, the moon in my window. How's that for focusing on the positive? That is an unattached guy. And that's a grateful guy. So gratitude is a practice. This is the thing about our minds, like Mary read about, you know, John O'Donohue's quote about our mind, you know, is the most potent thing in our lives. We can train our mind to be kinder. We can train our mind to have more joy. And we can train our mind to have more gratitude. But we have to consciously do it. We have to put in the effort. So one little gratitude exercise I like to do is to remember that really, if we really got our life at its deepest level, we would be grateful for everything. Why? Because we've already been given the biggest possible gift possible. That's good language. Possible gift possible. The gift of just being here, period. So we've been given this gift of life. I mean, isn't that miraculous? We were just born. And only maybe as an adult can we grow up and be like, oh my God, I've already been given the best gift I could ever have, being alive. But let's make this a little more tangible. So if you would, take two fingers of your left hand and cross your Adam's apple and find your pulse here. And see if you can find it good and strong. Really feel it. Let it be your mindfulness object. Isn't it amazing? All the ups and downs, your joys, your sorrows. This heart is in there beating. Steady, steady, steady. And strong. Can you feel how strong that is? And this heart is giving us the gift of life 60, 70, 80 times a minute. It is banging away. And it's powerful. You could sit literally 30, 45 minutes just feeling your heart and just say thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Every beat. It's amazing. And we totally can lose sight of this. And we get so locked into all of our drama in our sixth sense that we lose sight, you know, of the facts. And the facts are, our life is being constantly given to us. And this heart is just giving it to us. It's not ever asking for a thank you, for payment, for anything. It's just doing it. It's miraculous, isn't it? Here we are. So maybe from this perspective, then we can kind of feel like, wow, it's all gravy, the bad, the good, the ugly. The hailstorms, the absolutely fantastic week of weather we've had this week. You know, the tornadoes, all of it, it's like part of this wonder that our heart is giving us and that our birth is giving us. So this is a deep gratitude practice. I really recommend doing that at times. You know, in my work sometimes with depressed clients, you know, and depression can be such a sense of loss of vitality. But I have my clients feel their heartbeat, you know, for, 2, 3, 5, maybe even 10 minutes, and they feel that like something is really strong inside of me, really vital and really alive. They like it. And they get it that they're not just, these are not meditators, but they get it that, oh, I'm not just my thoughts. You know, there's a lot of other stuff going on. So, mudita, gratitude, and then we've all experienced this being here this week, haven't we? Just being in natural beauty. There's something about it. There's a scientific term for it, biophilia, that somehow our system really relaxes. When it's in its evolutionary crucible, which is not skyscrapers and concrete, you know, it's trees and clouds and grass, you know, and animals. That's the system we evolved in. So our system really somehow can come home if we're open to it. You know, we can be really conditioned out of it, but we can really feel like we come home in our senses in the natural world. And so, you know, the Buddha advised a lot not to be attached to sense pleasure. We do get a sense of something deeper and less fleeting when we're involved in nature, in the sense pleasure, but also the sense challenge, you know, the rain and the this and the that. We feel alive, our pores open up, you know, we just like it. So that's another way to keep joy going. Get out in nature a lot, even if it's just your garden, just your backyard. And remember, you always have the sky. If you live in a cityscape, skyscrapers and concrete are always in the vast open sky of nature. You can let your mind get big, just like we did on Icarus Point, anywhere you go. Look at the sky a lot. The Tibetans say if you gaze at the sky, you develop intuition and an easeful awareness. So that's another nature practice you could take home. Other practices. Why not be out on the lookout for humor? I mean, we pass around these New Yorker cartoons because we're on the lookout for it, you know? Be on the lookout for it. So if you're on the lookout for humor when you're driving home, you might see a highway sign that says warp drive. You might see a highway sign that says Punxsutawney 8, Paradise 3, Desire 5, and Panic 7. It's obviously in Pennsylvania. You might see a highway sign that says left lane closed when closed. You might see a sign that says 6 Mile Village, 3 miles. You might see, I don't know if this is really true or not. I got it off the internet, so who knows? Caution, this sign has sharp edges. Do not touch the edges of this sign. That is random. Okay, here's another one. It's a sign on a tree. Private sign, do not read. Here's a sign. This is a highway sign that you're supposed to read while you're driving. Left-hand turns prohibited to exit site onto Route 4 during the hours of 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., Monday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, 8 a.m. to 1 p.m., and during the two excessive traffic race weekends in Loudoun, New Hampshire, each year, and for motorcycle weekends. And then let's joke about religion, shall we? Why not? Let's joke about New Ageism. You know, the idea that you attract everything with your thoughts. Maybe there's some truth to that, but it's also a lot of pressure, isn't it? Everything I think I'm going to attract. So, but here are two ducks in a pond. This is a Bruce Eric Kaplan cartoon. Maybe you should ask yourself, one duck is saying to the other, why you're inviting all this duck hunting into your life right now. Here's a Buddhist compliment. I've never met anyone so thoughtless in my life. Here's Buddhist truth in advertising. A pudgy guy before, a really cut guy after, and then after that is a really old pudgy guy. Aw, come on. That's funny. Did I not explain it? Before, he's pudgy. He got all built and cut after. But then after that, then he's just an old frumpy guy. Buddhist truth in advertising? Maybe not. There was a fire on a street that had a lot of churches. And in the Episcopalian church, they ran in and grabbed the crucifix and ran out. And in the temple, they ran in, grabbed the Torah, and ran out of the temple. And the Unitarian Church, they ran in and grabbed the photocopier and ran out. And then finally, from the Jewish tradition, suddenly the rabbi in the temple has a big epiphany, and he runs up to the altar. Is that the right word? I'm not Jewish, so. What's the right word? Bima? He runs up to the Bima. How do you spell that? Okay. Runs up to the Bima and says, God, God, I see, I'm nobody. And the cantor peers her head in. And she has this big illumination, and she runs in and says, I see, God, I'm nobody. The janitor peers his head in and has this big illumination and runs in and kneels at the Bima and says, God, I see, I'm nobody. And the rabbi nudges the cantor. Look who thinks he's nobody. Aye. So, humor. We need it, don't we? A lot of it. If we weren't laughing, we'd be crying, right? Sometimes it feels that way. And what about play and singing and dancing? It's dharmic if you're being mindful. Mindful dancing is fun. You know, to just hear the backbeat, you know, and really hear the backbeat and let the backbeat move you, as opposed to, oh, I'm a white guy and here I am doing the white man's overbite. And I'm feeling so self-conscious. Forget about it. Hear the backbeat. Mindfully just hear the music, and then the music can move you. That's Billy Crystal, by the way. White man's overbite. So we can mindfully sing, and we can mindfully play. And so now I'm going to encourage us in a little mindful play singing. And it's a song. It doesn't have much of a tune, but it has some movement to it. So we can take ourselves less seriously and get our sillies on, I want to lead you solely with your acceptance. Just choose to move along with me or not for this song. And it's a song I learned when I was a camp counselor for elementary kids, and it's called My Aunt Came Back. So it's got words and it's got movements. I will have to move out here. So please say as I say and do as I do. My aunt came back.
My aunt came back.
From old Algiers.
From old Algiers.
And she brought me back.
And she brought me back.
A pair of shears.
A pair of shears.
Just see if you can be mindful.
Just
while you're cutting the air.
While you're cutting the air.
And don't feel very silly.
Don't feel very silly.
Because you've got a lot of company over there. My aunt came back.
My aunt came back.
From old Japan.
From old Japan.
And she brought me back.
And she brought me back.
An old hand fan.
My aunt came back.
From the county fair.
From the county fair.
And she brought me back.
And she brought me back.
A rocking chair.
A rocking chair.
My aunt came back.
From Gay Paris.
And she brought me back.
And she brought me back.
An itchy flea.
An itchy flea.
My aunt came back.
Back.
From Holland too.
From Holland too.
And she brought me back.
And she brought me back.
A wooden shoe.
A wooden shoe.
My aunt came back. From the city zoo.
From the city zoo.
And she brought me back.
And she brought me back.
Some critters like you. What was that?
You gotta put that on YouTube.
All of us. Yeah, this is a Buddhist retreat. I think it should go on the Vallecitos webpage. Imagine doing that with a room full of 8-year-olds. It's do it again time. Do it again. Do it again. We'll just do that like literally for 30 minutes. So we got to look for humor and then we got to get silly. That's joyful. And our little inner critic, I don't know about you, but my inner critic sometimes comes to me in the form of Maggie Smith, the actress, and the Dowager Countess from Downton Abbey, you know, disapprove. In the first episode, they really soften her and wisen her up, don't they, in the later episodes? But in the first, she's just pure disapproval, isn't she? So my inner critic's, you know, kind of like that. But then I say, well, if you're so old, why don't you just retire, you know? Our inner critics, you know, they're the biggest killjoy we have. So like our aimless wandering practice, you know, it's like hear the inner critic and do it anyway, you know? That's going to bring us more joy. You could do that aimless wandering practice. That's a take-home practice. Why not do that and call it meditation? Because it is. It's a mindfulness practice. So we need to do a lot. Mudita, gratitude, get out in nature, get in our bodies, in our five senses, dance and play and sing and laugh. And all you have to do, if you want to make it, you know, an officially approved Dharma activity, is actually really be mindful when you do it. And when you're mindful, it really deepens it. So really bring it into your play. I can feel my body just so much lighter. Feel your body. That's another thing. We want to really show up for the positive with rain, remember? And Leslie asked a question about, you know, why is that important? And that's a great question. We really need to show up, not just for the tough stuff. Really know what joy feels like in your body. So a little bit about integrating practice. I think we said a lot of it already. You know, I said you can't take concentration with you. You can't take mindfulness. It's always available. And also you can take this thirst or this longing that we all have for real happiness. That's a passion. It's a desire. It's a longing that really serves the spiritual path when you direct it in the right direction. The problem is not with desire. It's that we desire really fleeting things. So if we can target our desire towards our spiritual practice, not a desire like, I'm going to go to the cushion and I'm going to get X, Y, and Z out of it, but more like to remember that what we desire, you know, is deep, true happiness. And remembering that our practice is a way to do that. And, you know, that gets us to the cushion more. So Mary emphasized how important in integrating back into your life the practice community is. And some of you come from sanghas, the Santa Fe Sangha, the Durango Sangha, Boulder, Denver, you know, have sanghas. If you can, as much as possible, hang out with, you know, sangha people, connect with them. And the Buddha, you know, he didn't beat around the bush. He said, associate with the wise, don't associate with fools. You know, whatever that means to you. But for us, you know, it means, you know, who in our lives really are supportive of our deeper yearnings, our deeper longings. Those are the people to spend your time with. And we need it. You know, the culture's horrible. It's just absolutely fixated on youth. You know, like the six-pack abs, you know, that's like the totem of our culture. Instead of some wise, you know, sort of humble but broken-bodied man or woman, right? Those are not our icons. Our icons have nothing to do with wisdom. I could say almost anything and you're going to laugh, right? At this point, your funny bone has been tickled. It's good, it's good. See? You're in a good place. That's good. Feel the good place you're in. Actually, really be mindful right now as you're just like this. How nice. And feel so good about how hard you've worked. I'm such a noble thing, you know? It's not easy in our culture of, I mean, I think eventually ADD won't even be a diagnosis. It'll just be how everybody is because we're being so trained. We're practicing with our digital devices. We are practicing limited attention span, short, quick bursts of attention to lots of things. That's a kind of meditation. And so one thing we can do in life is to be really aware of our digital diet, you know, and be smart about how to limit it. You know, the things, you know, all the recommendations. Maybe only check your email twice a day, you know, instead of like every 10 minutes. Studies show that actually the more people do social media, the more anxious they are. It's not the kind of connecting that really relaxes us. So keep it simple when you can. Like we said, I was just going to say the Buddhist quote about a sangha, you know, Mary mentioned how important it is. Ananda said to the Buddha, wow, spiritual friendship seems so important. It seems like it must be half the holy life. And the Buddha said, not so. It's the whole of the holy life. It's all of the holy life. Deep friendship, because we come like sort of pre-approved and pre-processed. We can come into a mature, deep friendship because our mindfulness is helping us so much. Keep it simple. Just one more humor piece here. We're going to, you know, we want so much. And remember, that makes life really complicated. Remember, contentment is the greatest wealth. Being in your body, in your five senses, is such a happy way to be. But our culture is doing other things. And so here's kind of a spoof. This piece is called 100 Things You Honestly Don't Have to Do Before You Die. It's in The Guardian by Richard Osman. Oh my God, but he writes, OMG, you have to watch Breaking Bad. You simply have to. Stop whatever you're doing and watch it right now. Stop resuscitating that patient and watch Breaking Bad. Stop flying that plane, crash it into that field, and fire up Netflix. These days we're told we have to simply have to watch, to read, or just to do very many things. 100 things to do before you die, 100 films you have to see, 100 books you must read. I'm very keen to do what I'm told at all times. If I'm told there are 25 must-dive reefs or 30 Loganberry recipes you can't live without, then I take that responsibility very seriously and immediately go out shopping for scuba equipment and soft fruit. But while I can't stress enough that I don't wish to be a troublemaker, there's a slight problem with the math. The average human being will live for 701,844 hours. You'll be asleep for 233,600 of those hours. More if you're a cricket fan. He's English. You'll be working for 74,060 hours, and you'll be waiting for your children to hurry up and get their shoes on for 11,850. You suddenly find yourself with just 182,334 useful hours in your life for reading, watching films, and baking your signature Loganberry pecan flapjacks. Watching every film on the BFI's list of the greatest films of all time will take you 217 hours. Reading The Observer's 100 greatest novels, sum total of hours spent on books you simply have to read, 6,030. Isn't it time to end this tyranny? In the 70s, we weren't told what we had to do all the time, mainly because there were only about 8 things you could actually do. So everyone simply did all of them as a matter of course. The only films from the BFI's list that you must watch are Some Like It Hot, The Godfather, and Singing in the Rain. Of 100 greatest novels, you can happily ignore all of them except Scoop and The Prime of Miss Jean Brody. You must never swim with dolphins. If they ever want to swim with you, I'm sure they'll let you know. And by all means, go kiteboarding above the Andes. But that might be the thing you do literally just before you die. In reality, there are very few things you actually have to do before you die. They include ring your mom more often, recycle, watch the Book of Mormon. Please feel free to leave other suggestions online. The simple things, not the showy things, the things that make the world a better place. For example, popping bubble wrap. But before you do that, have you seen Breaking Bad? You must. Okay. We're at time. I just want to put in one last little plug, though. We're in so much natural beauty, and it's so, I don't know, people whispering. Sorry to say that again, but to be here. And, you know, our connection with the natural world needs to deepen. We need, the stats now are that the outdoor participation in youth has decreased by 60% since the 80s. I think probably because of the digital world. Let's get our youth outdoors in any way we can, because that's the future. And, you know, we also need to take our practice. We can't just sit on the cushion when we're integrating back with life. You know, we really need to do something. And this is just a blatant partisan pitch for helping Mother Earth and doing something about the climate crisis that we're in. It's just, you know, it's staggering what we're heading for. And the time is now, and we have to act. And our practice, we can't do it alone. So we have to do it together. We have to find other people and act with other people to make changes. And changes are coming, you know, like solar apparently has gotten much, much cheaper and is starting to really increase. But remember, it's too hard to do alone, and it's too hard to just sit around and feel so negative and hopeless about. We have to band together, and we have to act. And but our practice can open us, you know. It can give us the strength to act from love and not hate. I mean, I don't know if you're like me, but I have to check myself when I see a huge SUV going by with just one person in it. You know, and I have all kinds of judgments, and who knows, you know, they're not true, probably, hopefully. we have to act together from love and not demonize people, but act. And because the nature as we know it, you know, within our lifetimes could really change. And I'm a former biologist, so I know this on a fine-grained level. People who aren't that in touch with the ecological world, I remember my college roommate saying, you look at a picture of America, there's so much open space. But, you know, he didn't know anything about, you know, well, back then we didn't know much about climate change, but endangered species and loss of habitat, and now climate change is the biggest crisis of all. So, you know, sorry to end on a somber note after all our fun, but, you know, it's just my little partisan pitch on behalf of Mother Earth, our mother. Our practice is not just about inner work, it's about outer work and making the world better. So may it be so. Okay. Let's sit for a minute.